This is a Pinball News production.
Hi, thanks for coming. We're having a little bit of trouble with our presentation, so I'm going to start by giving the Farsight history. I'm Bobby King. I'm the Vice President of Product Development at Farsight Studios. We make the pinball arcade for pretty much every device, console, video game platform that's out there. And I'm going to be basically telling you like how we got to make the game, and then with the help of Norman Stepanski, who's a senior producer and our audio guy, he'll be helping to explain like how we buy the tables, take them apart, and get the reference that we need to make the tables. Jason Gino is the art director. He'll be telling us how we model the different parts, texture the pieces, texture the play field, and get the games looking as real as we can get them to look. So Farsight began back in 1989. It was founded by Jay Obernolte in his dorm room at Caltech. And over the next couple years, he started making educational software and eventually started making sports games. And we made some really hardcore football games for a long time. We made the first-party football games for Sega. We made NCAA football for EA. And then we made an ESPN football game for Konami. After that, the NFL pulled the license away from Konami. So as a game studio, most studios would go under, as that was our one gig. But what Jay did is he funded us to make an action puzzle game which featured a ball which rolled around puzzles. And basically whatever color the ball was, you could break that color block. And we sold it to a publisher that had a really good ability to market into value spacing. And what they really wanted, Mojo did pretty well, which was the action puzzle game, they really wanted a pinball game. So they came to us and was like, can you guys, it's a great mass market title. Can you guys design us some pinball tables? And, as the production department, I was like, there's some really good original pinball tables out there I knew of, and I was a big fan of pinball, but I didn't feel comfortable trying to design pinball tables. Like, I've never tried. So what we did is we went to the Pinball Hall of Fame. Before it was the Pinball Hall of Fame, it was in Tim Arnold's backyard in a big airplane hangar, and he was having these fundraisers to raise money to start the Hall of Fame. So we talked to him about, what licenses could we get to recreate, the best tables that we remember, growing up with. And, we thought about Williams and Bally tables first, but he said, Gottlieb would probably be an easier license for us to get. So we went around his warehouse and we, saw that he had like a really good, actually he has every Gottlieb table that's ever been manufactured. So it was a good collection to pick from for the reference, once we got up and running. Oh, so someone's moving along, all right. So we got the license for Gottlieb, and it came out on Xbox, came out on the PlayStation 2, but it was just, on consoles. This was before, smartphones or anything. And the game did really well. They sold it at a really nice price point. It was like $19.95. And the game sold wonderfully. So with the knowledge that a pinball game that's a recreation of famous tables could do well, we went out and we spent more money on the Williams license and made the Pinball Hall of Fame the Williams collection. And this game, when we went out to make it, we revamped the physics. One thing that Roger Sharp at WMS was very adamant about is he thought our game, the Gottlieb collection, was pretty good. But it wasn't up to the standards that he would expect the gameplay to look and feel. So we basically redid the physics completely from scratch. And the game was much better. The game looked better. And the game sold much worse, which we really couldn't understand. It was probably because when we came out, the PlayStation 2 and the original Xbox were fairly new. And most of their users were like, the first adopters. And those people want, the AAA titles where you're killing everyone. And it really hadn't sold in that much. What we wanted to do was to sell it on PSN. But our license with WMS didn't include that. And we kept trying to get them to agree. And they saw that competing too much with, PC license, that they might want to hold on and use some other way. So Even though the Williams Collection didn't do that well, we were very proud of the game, and our vision as a company, you know, we've been a video game developer since 1989, basically working under contract for publishers. But our vision for the way the video game industry was going was for digital distribution. And how that works is, instead of, you know, selling your retail product into stores, people can download it from XBLA or the PlayStation Network or iTunes, the App Store, and PC. It's Steam is the big player now. And once the manufacturing and having a warehouse and inventory and distribution is taken out of the picture, we were like, we're going to be a publisher. So this really started happening, you know, actually once the iPhone took off and the App Store started showing how anyone could make games pretty much as long as you can get exposure and get noticed, the game would do pretty well. We decided that the time for us to start working on it was now. And we were really proud of the Spinball game that we made. You know, even the Williams Collection didn't sell that great. If we can convince all the pinball manufacturers to give us a license, we can continue to basically preserve Americana, which we see, you know, our role in the pinball community is, you know, we're taking all these greatest tables of all time and recreating them as close as we possibly can. And they'll explain, you know, a little bit like how we do that. But, you know, our goal is to, you know, a lot of people don't have access to pinball anymore. Either they're people who grew up with pinball and they can't find the pinball tables that were their favorites, or they are interested in playing pinball now. We want to basically preserve these great games that, you know, that we loved growing up. So our goal in our vision is to create the pinball arcade, to make it so that we have 40 tables out now. And our goal is to basically get about 80 to 90% of the top 100 tables of all time. And, you know, we'll include tables from every manufacturer. And, you know, one of the big challenges is licensing. So we started with the Gottlieb license, like I said. And then we went out and we got the Williams deal. But in order to see our vision come to fruition, we needed more licenses. You know, there's a lot of great Bally tables, a lot of great Stern tables, you know, Data East, Sega. There's plenty of tables out there that we didn't have the license to, so we felt if we're going to do this, we're going to go out and we're going to basically get the license to every table we possibly can. So we got these four licenses for the manufacturers, and originally Gary Stern, the first time I met Gary Stern was at a convention in Vegas. It was for like coin op stuff, and we went up to him. We asked, you know, we told him who we were, and Roger Sharp was with us, and you know, he was explaining, you know, the Williams Collection was doing, you know, okay, and he was wondering if Gary would be interested, and Gary was completely against it. He was like, "There's no way I'm ever going to license you guys with anything because you guys are going to compete against us. You're taking away my sales. Like, why would I ever do this?" And luckily, over the next couple of years, some people there at Stern convinced him that it might be a good idea to, you know, give people who haven't played the older Stern tables the opportunity to play these. They'll get some interest in these tables, and as a marketing tool, possibly coming out with tables when Stern does for some marketing exposure and PR, which is something we're still working on. The problem with that is licensing is really difficult with the tables Gary's been coming out with the last few years. So one of the biggest challenges we have is in getting the ancillary licenses to all these tables. If you look at the top, you know, 50 tables, over half of them have licenses, you know, like, you know, Star Trek or Twilight Zone or Adam's Family. So the biggest challenge we have, well, there's two big challenges. One is companies want a lot of money, money that makes it impossible for us to consider making or even breaking even on a table. And some companies don't want anything to do with us. Basically, we're not offering enough money to make it interesting to them. They're used to people paying seven figures for a Terminator license or a Star Trek license, or like if we wanted a Batman or any superhero, forget it. So it's there are a couple licenses out there. Like anything Disney-related is going to be really difficult for us to get. But we're in Warner Brothers is also been tough. But there's, you know, we've made a little bit of progress, I think, you know, by getting CBS to give us Star Trek and Twilight Zone and Universal, the Creatures from the Black Lagoon and Monster Bash. So the other big challenge is they want, even the companies that are willing to work with us, they want a fair amount of money. So we've used Kickstarter to basically have our fans help us fund these games. And it's been really good for us because not only do the fans help us, you know, fund the license costs that we need, but it's great PR. You know, people who are big fans of Star Trek or Terminator, you know, they hear about these Kickstarters, they hear about our game, and they're excited. They might even be introduced to our game before their table comes out. But once our table comes out, they'll download it, they get the launch pack, they start remembering, you know, a lot of these tables that are in there. So it's been really good using Kickstarter. And Ripley's Believe It or Not was in our table, was in our launch pack. And the reason why it was in a launch pack was it was the first licensor I could get a hold of that was actually willing to work with us. Because another problem we have in licensing is that a lot of licensors don't want to be the first one to, like, basically sign on to a product. They want to know, like, what other big licenses do you have before they're willing to sign a deal? So luckily we're past that step, but we needed Ripley's Believe It or Not to get a Stern table in our launch pack, and I think it's a pretty good table too. One thing that we've noticed is that, and I don't know if you guys have noticed this too, but we have to actually buy all these tables as part of our process, and Norman will get to that.
Yeah.
The price of pinball tables has been going up, and specifically the price of the tables of some of the ones that we've done, like Ripley's, went up a lot. And this is one of the things that Gary Stern noticed when it came to getting his license, getting basically his interest that we might not just be this small little game that won't really help him out too much, but if he looks at the price of how much Ripley's has gone up over the first year or two we came out and consider how much the price or the interest in some of his newer tables might go up, he's definitely willing to work with us, you know, even more. So now I'm going to hand it over to Norman, because it's Norman's job in the beginning of part of our process is to buy the pinball tables, those prices going up. So,
hi. I'm going to stand way over here, and Mike is going to magically know where I want these pictures to change, so it's going to be very exciting. I'm a producer there, as he said. I'm the audio director. And, you know, a producer at a small company, a relatively small company like ours, video company, producers do a lot of different jobs. Everybody wears a lot of hats because there's a lot of jobs to do, and if it's not being done by an animator or a programmer or an artist, it falls to a producer, and it doesn't really matter what it is. One of the jobs I get to do, which is just the coolest, is I'm what they around there what we call the real world pinball guy. And so I buy the pinball tables, I arrange the shipping for them. When they get there, I'm the one that takes them apart when they need to be taken apart. If they break, I'm the one that's supposed to fix them. I've been fixing tables for about 3 years, and at this point, just about everything I see is new. Someone's going to have to tell me when I start feeling comfy with this. And with the repair stuff, I've had some really good successes, and I've had some stunning failures also. So where are we? Oh, no, go back. Thanks. This is our so we have 35 pinball tables at Farsight right now. And they're all over the place, and I don't know where I'm going to put them. I'm running out of room for pinball tables. We have a relatively big place, but we haven't talked about selling them yet because we love them. Nobody wants them to go away. So I'm not sure where I'm going to put them for season 3, but I'm going to have to figure out something. And I really don't want them out of the building. I want them to be playable. So right now, this is a picture of our pinball room. Oh, go wet. I'm still in the pinball room. Thank you. This is a picture of our pinball room. And right behind that teed-off table, there's a long table back there where I put the pieces. And when I disassemble something, this is the room that I usually do it in. It's never this clean. I just cleaned it up for this picture. It probably doesn't look like that anymore right now. But anyway, go to the next one. This is our conference room. And so it's filled with pinball tables, as you notice. That one in the middle there, I'm not really sure what it is. It might be the first table of Season 3, but I'm not positive. We may never know what that table is. Go ahead. You can always play a game of pinball whiner with on the way to the bathroom. Go ahead. You know, so every office downstairs has one or two pinball tables in it right now. The offices upstairs do not have pinball tables because I have not made the leap to drag them upstairs. But I'm going to soon. I'm going to have to drag about six of them up there so I can at least get into Season 3. That's Bobby's. That last one was Bobby's office. He has two in there. Yeah, okay. this is one of our programmer's offices, and he likes Gorgar a lot. And so we moved it into his office, but he was a little afraid that his wife wouldn't like the risque back glass. And so he cut a piece of construction paper and made her a tasteful outfit. And it's lovely, I think. So let's talk about shipping pinball tables. One of the crosses that we have to bear is we live up on the top of a mountain in Big Bear Lake, which is a lovely place to live and work. But we have to drive pinball tables up a mountain. Of the 35, 36 tables we have there, I've probably bought five of them locally, and every single one I've had to have shipped. We've probably spent upwards of $10,000 in shipping. That is a tough pill to swallow. But, you know, imagine the tables I could buy with that. But there's nothing we can do about it, and usually when we're looking for a table, we need to buy it now. So if you want your table to be cheap, you know, or less expensive, the best way to do that is know what you want and wait. And just look and wait until you find that deal. This is something we can't do because we've got a schedule. So when I find them, I find the best deal I can within the 2 weeks or so that I'm looking for one, and I just say, this is it, and I take it, and I ship it out. And the shipping usually costs over $400 to do. And it's just we've just got used to it. So when we ship a table, our side of it always has an extra charge on it because they call us a rural area, that we're more than 50 miles away from the distribution site. And so we get charged always a little bit extra because of where we live. But if it also gets picked up on the other side and they're also a rural area, this is what happens. This is Canton, Ohio. This is the distance from Canton, Ohio to Big Bear Lake, basically. The next one is the distance from Bakersfield, California to Big Bear Lake, California. I can drive there in 2.5 hours, something like that. Okay, pull that out. It costs $20 more to ship a table from Bakersfield, California than it does from Canton, Ohio to Big Bear Lake. I've been asking people to explain that one to me, but they really can't. I'm just not sure what's going on there, but that's just, again, this is just what we have to go with. We just make the deal, we pay the money, and we get our table, which is always very exciting. So after we get the table, the first thing that I have to do is as the, quote, real-world pinball guy, is I start working with Steve Elinoff, the emulation engineer. And he has to know exactly how that table works in real life, exactly what's going on with the electronics inside, exactly how the sounds are being handled inside the machine. He can do a lot of that where he is in Georgia, but we have the table where we are. And so sometimes, first of all, this is just a picture of a manual, and I do a lot of that for him. We have a manual on our side. Sometimes he has one on his side. If he doesn't, I start taking pictures of the manual. I take pictures of all the important schematics and everything so he can have them. I also take pictures of the back box if he needs them, sometimes close up of certain boards. He might ask me to take a multimeter and get readings off of something. So he and I are working back and forth together to make sure that finally he understands exactly what the table is doing and he can get start setting up the emulation. Okay. Back up. I didn't know that one was coming. After we do that part, I take the table apart, so that we can get all the pieces onto an artist's table. So all the pieces are sitting right in front of an artist when they do them, so they can be measured and modeled perfectly. And so we can get a picture of the play field. And so what's coming up here is a little animation we made once of parts coming off. Silly, but. Next one. That's a picture of a playfield that's been stripped and That's what the first picture usually looks like. You can see that we don't take it apart completely. I leave the rails that you would never want to take off of a pinball table if you didn't have to. I leave those on. I leave stuff on that would be a giant pain to try to take off, and unless it's right in the way of something that's important, then I have to take it off. But basically, we just want a good shot of all of the visible play field, certainly of the light inserts, real important, and we take a super high quality picture of that and move it on to an artist. What's next? Champion Pub. Champion Pub is one of those amazing failures that I had. I took Champion Pub apart. It was working absolutely perfectly. It was a lovely table, and when it went back together, everything was wrong with it. So we got a lot of it fixed again. I actually had to call, that's the one time I had to call a repair guy to actually come up and help me. He did get the table working for, because right after this phase, what I need to do is I need to get it back together again. I have to make sure the lights are working and that the table is working well enough. The next guy who gets it is the guy who writes the instructions. So the thing really has to work well. And I just want to stop for a second, and because I always forget to tell people this at the expo booth, that we have the greatest instruction set of any place in the entire world. And I always forget that this is a feature. I just take it for granted. I don't know how many people who play our game have actually bothered to look at the instructions. But when we make our instructions, if you wanted the best instructions that you could possibly get for pinball, you would start looking through the internet and see what people have done already. That's where we start. And we get all that stuff, and we collect all that stuff. Then a guy takes the table, and he locks himself in a room for a week, and you never see him, and he writes absolutely perfect detailed instructions. And if you haven't seen it, it's all graphic. It's got arrows. It's all one sentence at a time. It shows you exactly what eject something is, where exactly what lane you have to go up. And also, if you see instructions that are like on the internet that say, hit the left ramp and then go to the right orbit and hurry up because you don't have much time, right? Our instructions will say, hit the left ramp and get to the right orbit. You only have 5 seconds, right? Every detail, I'm telling you. And sometimes I ask people, our launch pack is 4 tables, and I always ask them, if I told you I would sell you the greatest instruction set you have ever seen for Theater of Magic, Black Hole, Tales of the Arabian Nights, and Ripley's Believe It or Not for $10, would you buy it? And they said, absolutely. And I said, there might be a game attached to that, but you don't have to play it if you don't want to. Anyway, so what's next? Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about how we do the sound in this game. Some of you will recognize this as the Pinball Hall of Fame in Las Vegas. Gottlieb Collection, like he was saying, we were tied up with Pinball Hall of Fame, and they were very, very good to us, and we got all of our reference and all of our sound from Pinball Hall of Fame. This was before we were buying pinball tables, and so we got everything inside that building. We thought they'd be closed when we actually did that project, but they weren't. They were fully open, and people were playing pinball all over the place while we were trying to capture sound. And there was a teenage boy around there who had this goofy, obnoxious, loud laugh, kind of, and he was there for hours and hours, and we had to figure out how to get sound captured and not get this goofy frickin' laugh in there. And under the circumstances, they did a fantastic job. But it wasn't the optimum way to do things like we do now, but it was the beginning of it. The next step was, this is, if you recognize this is a picture of the PinMame sound commander. And the next thing that we did is we started searching through the ROMs for the sounds. And it was kind of a hunt and peck thing. I had to go through and just go through all the numbers, all the location numbers in it, and hope that I hit something. And it took a long time. It was real tedious. If I didn't find it, I would have to go to the table and record it. And go ahead. This is the old sound setup during that time. I used to pull an entire tower and monitor down to the pinball machine, and it was real bulky, but it worked. It worked really well, but it was a gigantic hassle. But that's how I did Funhouse. I think Taxi was the only one that I actually figured out how to get the first time that I had figured out how to get the audio directly off the board, which is a good idea and a bad idea. I'll talk about that in a second. But This was pretty workable at the time, but it was definitely an upgrade from the way we were doing it before. Good. Never found Rudy's voices, ever, on anything. I know they're on that ROM somewhere, but even Steve Elinoff doesn't know where that is. The RM emulation engineer doesn't know where that is. I've talked to a lot of people. Has anybody ever played around with PinMame and found Rudy's voices on there? Anyway, Rudy's voices, I had to go back into the table and I had to coax him to say everything he's supposed to say. I think there's a couple of lines in there of the list that I had of what he was supposed to say that I was never able to get him to say. But when I do something like that, I have to take all the mechanicals down. I have to take all the coils off. I have to take all the slingshot. I have to take everything down so nothing fires off while that's happening. What's next? That's me relaxing because at that point in the process, when Steve Elinoff was fully involved, he started ripping the sounds for me because he had automated that process, that PinMame process, so it didn't have to be hunted by a human being. That's right. So he made that a lot easier, certainly for me. The next thing is, it really started to get fun after this. Steve figured out how to give me a custom, you see we had them burned at Kay's Arcade. He made me a custom game chip and a custom sound chip, and that allowed me to use the coin door buttons. Sometimes the coin button, the start button, all the stuff that's on the coin door, in order to advance the game through its sounds, and it started playing it. And then we could record the sounds straight through the speaker. The reason that's very cool is that in some pinball tables, they're doing things after. They record it in a certain way for a certain reason. Sometimes they record those things real trebly or real hot, right? And then they have electronics that tone them down a little bit, right? We only know that if we rip the sound and it sounds a little goofy to us and we make it sound ungoofy. But we don't really know what the post-processing of that sound is. Some tables are doing a great deal more of it than others. By getting the table to play it out, we get all of that line. And that's really good. That's when this started. We were able to record off the table. We started doing this. Centaur is one of the tables that was recorded this way. And I think the Centaur sound is fantastic. It just sounds great. Yeah, go ahead. This is the way we're doing it now. Steve went and got this. This is an Arduino board. You can get them at Radio Shack, and they're a hobby board that you can write your own software into and do lots of interesting projects with. Go to the next one. This is the screen of the software that he made for me, and you can see what it does. I get he sends me exactly the connector that I need to go right into the soundboard, directly into the soundboard. And when I turn the thing on, I have all of this control. I can go backwards and forwards through the sound. I can find out if there's something playing under something, which is something we couldn't do before. There's just a lot of things that I can do with this, and it just makes it very, very slick. And Steve Elinoff is a wildly smart guy. Centaur. Reason I brought Centaur up is that Gottlieb tables. A lot of the Gottlieb tables have a trick in them that is very annoying to us. But it works pretty well for what they want it to do. Centaur is the best example of that. It has a soundtrack that is playing live out of a synthesizer, right? So remember, we're doing all WAV files. We have to record things into WAV files. We're not emulating the ROM. It's not playing out exactly like the table. Sometimes we have to trick it to make it sound like what they want it to do that they are doing live. So this is playing a synthesizer out live, right? And then every time something gets hit, the speed of it goes up just a tiny bit. You don't even notice it the first couple of times, but if you play the table for a little while, all of a sudden the soundtrack starts getting faster and faster and faster and faster. In the case of Centaur, it gets faster for a long time, and then all of a sudden it slows down again. But when it slows down, does it go back to the first file? No! It goes back to a file that's just slightly faster than that, and it speeds up again. Then it goes down to a file that's slightly faster than that, and it speeds up again. So in order to get that in Centaur, there is, I believe, if I remember correctly, there's 12 sets of 40 WAV files in order to get that working well enough so that you don't feel it get to the end. Some of you probably have gotten to the end of that and it goes all the way back to the beginning, but I'm betting you don't care at that point because your eyes are bleeding, I would imagine. But So anyway, that's a lot of Gottlieb tables would do that. There's some other tables that have that trick in it. This is the most extreme one. The thing that's really weird about that is that then we have to get this table down to a very, very, very small size in order to get it on an iPhone, right? In the consoles, we can do anything we want, but we really have to get this thing small. So luckily, we didn't have to do anything weird with Centaur, but other tables that have very big sound requirements are going to lose some textures, or something else is going to have to come out in order to get that game small enough that we can actually submit it to Apple. I think I only have a couple more. Yeah, two more. This is the Zoom H2. This replaced that entire old sound setup that I had there. I use this for everything. It's a digital handheld. 3.5, 4 years ago, it cost me $180. This is the deal of a century. This is the most fantastic recorder you could possibly get. If anybody ever needs any recording like this, come and talk to me about it. It's just a fantastic device. Like I said, I use it for everything. And this is the setup in my office. This is the mixing setup. Those are NS10 speakers. It's kind of an old style, you know, a standard studio setup for what they call near-field monitoring, when you're sitting very close to the speakers. And so those are NS10s. There's Oratone sound cubes on top of that. That's a 200-watt amp. But I have lots of references. And truthfully, I like the TVs. I like to know what something is going to sound like on a TV set because that's where people are going to be doing it. So I have an array of headphones. I've got these things. And so it's dangerous to mix something, especially for a video game, only on excellent equipment because it sounds great to you, but it's not going to play through that. And so what you're really looking for is something that's going to sound good on lots of things. So on this set of headphones, recorded in your car, blah, blah, blah. Not that I do that on every game because I know my studio well enough. I know the speakers well enough. But that's the idea, that I shouldn't be able to put on a set of headphones, earbuds, different TVs, and be astonished by how badly it sounds in any one of them. It's got to sound kind of good on all of them. And so that's the deal. That's all I have. Jason's coming up now. He's our art director.
All right. How's it going, guys? I'm the art director over at Farsight. So our job on the art department is basically to, once he takes the table apart, which once we get in the office, that's our first job. And we basically take reference pictures. He showed you that picture of the playfield. But we have to then recreate it in 3D. So you can probably go to the next. So, like, you know, this is obviously the cowboy from Cactus Canyon. So we recreate that in 3D programs. We use from Maya to Max. We use ZBrush a lot if we're doing toys. You know, in Photoshop, we have to create textures so we can get this into our game. So, as you can see on this video, it's kind of hard to see probably from where you're sitting, but we have what's called polygons to make this in 3D, and each polygon is a four-sided face, and that gets converted into triangles. So each face is basically two triangles. And that's one of our main issues trying to do this, because once you put that on the phone, like once you have that the whole table put together, you only have so many basically triangles that you can put in there before you start seeing performance problems. And so basically, you know, what you're going to run into is some of the lower devices, we've got about 25,000 triangles that we can use. And then up to the higher phones, you've got about 45,000. And then on the consoles, it's not really an issue. So you can see without the wireframe, the next one is, this is what it looks like fully textured and what it'll show up like in game. You can go to the next one. So here's, once Norman has the table taken apart, we, like he was saying, we take a high definition picture of the playfield, and that's what we start everything from. Basically, that gives us our dimensions, how long the table is, how wide the table is, and we base everything off of that. Like he said, it's really, we have to work with him because it's really hard to take a lot of these parts off. Because ideally for us, if he could get everything off of there, the better. Because if we have any shadows or like the pop bumpers, like you see on that picture, we've got to go clean that out in Photoshop. We take as much of that away as we can so you don't see it when you're playing the table. You don't want to see that part of the image on the playfield. So like I said, that's our starting point. That gives us our measurements, which is a big part because precision is huge. I'm sure a lot of you guys, when you're working on pinball tables, like any part that moves, it's usually a tight fit. And so when we're recreating this, we have those same limitations. So if we're working on Bride and we're rotating her face, and if it's too big or not, if it's not perfect, it doesn't work correct. I mean, we still have the same emulations states, and so they're same way they rotate that face. We have to recreate it so it works perfectly. You can go to the next one. I was talking about precision. So yeah, you can keep going. So part of the biggest problem when we're recreating it in 3D is once we take like something like any ramp in any pinball table, once he takes it off the table, they don't hold their shape, at least their pitch. So once we recreate them, there's a lot of back and forth that we have to go until we get it, the exact height. So that's why we measure everything. That's a big part of our process on the art side, is making sure, like, at this point of the ramp, it's the right height. At each section as the ramp goes along, we want to make sure that it keeps the exact same height that it does have in the game. That way the ball rolls at the right speed. It does, it doesn't make up the ramp if you don't hit it hard enough, based on like the exact same thing it does in the table. You want it to, as far as the speed of the ball, you want it to react the same way. And then the toys, I mean, most tables have some version of the toy. And then that's a big part of, again, where precision comes in. The train on Cactus Canyon, it moves, it's got basically two docking stations, and it's got to be exactly the right size, otherwise it'll clip through the table on one end, or it won't actually fit in its docking station on the other end. And again, measuring as much reference as we can get, that's why we have Norman take apart the table. We measure everything, and it helps us make sure that we can get the table done in time. So, and lighting is it's our next a big issue. It's a big challenge for us, because on the performance is a big problem, because our physics run, we really need to be at 60 frames per second in order for our physics to run, which we'll get into when we get into some of the programming. But like for the phone specifically, we can't really do any lighting. It's all just straight textures. And then when you get into the 360, we can start doing what we'll do, like the light cutouts. So again, it's kind of a trick we use to make it feel like it's being lit. So we'll actually cut out each light that's on a table. You can go to the next one, and it'll show you kind of how it works. So like the purple circles, those are basically our 3D meshes that we use to recreate the lights. So that'll sit, it won't actually be that far up off the play field, it'll actually be lowered. And we'll actually texture swap. We'll have an off state, which looks like the light when it's off, and we'll have an on state, which looks like the light when it's on. And when I give those to code, he'll tie those into the emulation, so it knows like when this light turns on, it switches the texture to the on state. And that's how we do it that's why we don't have any actual lighting on the phone, but we can texture swap and make it look like lights are going on and off. And so that's a process that really it makes a world of difference, because I don't know how we would do it otherwise. But once we started getting into these next consoles, if you can go to the next images, we're starting to get into dynamic lighting. So if you've seen anything that we've been doing on the PlayStation 4, I mean, it's amazing how much visually we can recreate now. So like what you'll see is every single one of those orbs is an actual dynamic light placed in 3D that actually will light everything around it. So what we've been able to do is every single light on a table, we can actually physically put a light in 3D. So something like Scared Stiff, I mean, we're at like 120 to 150 lights per table. And so the biggest effect that this creates for us on the PlayStation was when like a light goes off, it actually gets dark around it, where it doesn't have any light anymore. That's something that we couldn't do with a texture swap. When it goes off, you don't, all you're doing is the bright is going away. What we can do here is now, like a lot of tables, once you complete something, it actually changes the GI in the table, the general illumination. And so now we can actually, if it turns all the lights off in the emulation, our table will go dark. It'll recreate the same effect, which is really cool on the PlayStation. So the last part of our process is doing the collisions, because that's basically how the table works. we basically create the boundaries for where the ball can and can't go. So this is like an example of what the collisions look like. So this is stuff that happens. It's not drawn, so it's behind the scenes. You never see it, but it's also basically what keeps the ball playing. It's what the physics are all tied into. So when we get to the programming side, they'll be able to explain how these actually help, or how these actually work with the ball physics. So each one, we actually separate them in, like the rubbers will have their own collisions, the flippers have their own collisions, targets, metal pieces, that kind of stuff. That way in code, they can actually give those different physics numbers. So if you want it to bounce really strong, like on a rubber piece, then they actually can give it, in the physics, give it a bounce number to keep it from, to bounce really hard or soft, however they want it. And that's basically the art process.
Thanks, Jason. Next, I was going to have Mike Reitmeier, who's the lead gameplay programmer, come up and talk about the improvements we've made to the physics and the process of programming, taking everything that that Norman and Jason give them to putting it into the game and then deploying it on all the different consoles and all different platforms we come out on. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it because we're kind of on a tight deadline for our next release, due out next Friday. So I'm going to go through just the highlight the engine improvements that we've made. One of the main goals we have is to do two tables a month. And in our old process, we never would have been able to do that without some major improvements or things to speed up in the pipeline. And one was creating what we called the CSV file. And in the CSV file is where Jason sets up the lighting and I do all the tuning for the gameplay. It's every object in the table has its own basically little section and has its own set of physics, so I can tweak everything individually and allow it to play as accurate as I can. Another thing that we also wanted to improve was the speed and accuracy of the physics engine, and the way that we did that was by, in addition to detecting the collision with the collision mesh like you just saw Jason had, is we now use something called bounding shapes as well as the meshes, which is a lot faster processor-wise. The collision detection system also had its issues in the second generation, which was what the Pinball Hall of Fame, the Williams Collection, was running on, where it wasn't running fast enough. It runs at 60 frames a second, so when the frame rate drops below 60, it kind of has issues with the ball going through stuff. So one of the ways we improve that is, one, we try to make a hard rule of hitting 60 frames a second and keeping it there. And the other is we've implemented this thing called the stepping method, which is we actually have the ball step through where it would go a multiple number of times every frame. And the magic number we've come on is 6 times per frame. Any more than that, we have frame rate hitches in the calculations that this takes. But if we're calculating 6 times per frame, that's every second the engine is basically calculating 360 different positions of the ball, which is quite a bit, for every 1/60th of a second, if you can imagine. That's pretty accurate. One thing that we do now is, if on some of the older phones, if the frame rate is going to drop below 60, we don't mess with a variable frame rate. We basically lock the frame rate to 30 frames a second. It's a little hitchy, and pinball really wants 60 in order to have the ball moving in a nice smooth way so that you can react and hit it with the flippers. So what we do is we run the physics twice at 30, and we get better results as far as the accuracy of the physics engine. Next, we have emulation, which we've talked a little bit. Mike works a lot with Steve Elinoff remotely, and he's hooking up all the different switches, getting basically everything that Steve has and putting it into our physics engine is actually quite a bit of work, and it's definitely worth it. I mean, one of our goals is to emulate every solid state machine in our game, where in the past, if you've played the Gottlieb Collection and tried playing like Teed Off, for instance, you notice that we didn't get the DMD right at all, and we had at least 50 different errors in the rules, where with emulation the table plays a lot better. There's a couple drawbacks to using emulation, And those are detecting goals is a lot more difficult. One of the features of our game is you have 10 goals on every table. You have 5 normal goals and then 5 wizard goals that kind of, you know, test your ability to play and get through all the different modes. In order to detect whether or not you've completed a goal, we have to rely on whether or not something displays in the DMD or whether or not a certain sound is played or a certain sequence of, you know, table lights is gone off. It's not as reliable as you'd think because there's a lot of different modes and ways to get table goals to be achieved. It takes like a week, you know, to get all the goals implemented and actually debugged. Where if we were actually scripting the table with our own code of gameplay rules, it's really easy. You complete a goal, you know, you're running this routine and then goal completed. But relying on the emulation makes it harder. So the programmers integrate the art that Jason was describing into the engine. It's a fairly straightforward process of using the CSV to hook it all up. And basically, after all that's done, you know, the table starts, and then he can eject a ball and start playing. And after that, it's basically time to start tuning. And tuning is a lot of back and forth with the art staff to make sure all the objects are working, all the collisions are there, and that the toy is working the way they should. And lastly, they put in the floor lamps and the flashers and hook them up. And after that stage, it goes on to tuning, fixing bugs, and adding new tuning features when necessary. And that's when I come in at the end process of getting everything into the engine, is it's time to basically tune the game and make it play, not just look and sound, but play as close to the real thing as we can. And so the CSV, as we mentioned, you know, has all those different parameters. I have a little diagram there, you know, showing the flipper collision on the bottom, the basement of Haunted House, and a little portion of the CSV file that shows basically like some plunger parameters and some flipper numbers. It's really the tuning that I do is manipulating a lot of different numbers in a file and a lot of back and forth to make sure that it feels right with the experience of how it's worked on other tables. And then in addition to getting it, you know, feeling right, the collisions have to be tweaked a little bit. So I've got on the left-hand side, you can see the collision to that wall. You see the mesh of it. You know, how the ball comes out of an arc or an orbit or comes off a ramp is very dependent on exactly where those polys and those tries are basically, you know, sending it. And with the use of, you know, tweaking exactly where those angles are and tweaking the physics numbers, I can get the ball to basically feed wherever it should. And on the right-hand side, let's go on. And once I've made the first pass, which is basically making a pass, making sure everything on the table's at least playing right, and all the kickers are coming out, all the traps are kicking out to the right spot, all the ramps feel about right, then the next process is handing it off to Josh Sharp and Scott Shelton. Josh looks at it from a standpoint of the IP all being correct and the game feeling right from a pinball, like a real-world pinball player's expertise. And he does a great job of basically finding everything that we've missed, even on the art side, of making sure everything's very accurate. Scott, internally, he's the guy who writes the instructions, so he knows the table really well. And what he's looking at is the game from a video game player standpoint and trying to see, you know, whether or not the game feels right in comparison to our other tables. And the two of them combined give me a lot of comments. They give feedback to the programming staff, to the artists, and for me for tuning. And eventually, after, I don't know, probably like 3 back and forth, maybe 4, we've got the table to a point where it can go to QA, which is the next step in the process. In QAs, we internally have a test team that goes through all the tables, and they're playing it looking for bugs. And there's still, you know, after all this process that we've gone through so far, there's still bugs in there. There's still collisions that aren't, you know, quite right. There's still little some modes might not trigger like all the times they should. There might be some issues when it comes to art that they're looking at the tables that we have versus the table in the game. And you know, sometimes it's the fact that we've actually bought a table that's been modded, so we have to close those bugs out. And there's also, I want to mention the Pinball Arcade fans. They do a great job. It's a website of guys who are hardcore fans, and they go through. We send them a build before we're ready to finish up and ship it, and they go through and they play the tables. They're also hardcore pinball fans in addition to being fans of our game. Looking for little things that might go wrong, and they do a great job of keeping track of all the issues that they've found over the different months, and whether or not something's been fixed, and whether or not other people have been noticing whether or not something doesn't feel quite right. Because one thing that's nice about the way that we do our game, games in the old days, you basically shipped it on disk and it was done. Now, since everything is digitally distributed, we have the ability to basically update and improve everything, as the months go on and people find things wrong. So we're always on the lookout for fixing stuff and improving the game. So that's pretty much all we have. Do we have any time for questions? All right. So, anyone has a question?
For the QA part, since you're testing things that it would take a realistic player to get to, do you have some backdoor stuff that helps speed that process up?
Yeah, we do. We have, it's called ball control.
It's a lovely thing. You like it.
And actually, we actually allow players to access it. All of our tables are sold the regular mode and the pro version. And in the pro version, you're able to steer the ball around. So when you have the ability to steer the ball around the table, it's pretty easy to get to the more difficult goals and get through the modes of the table to find any mode-based bugs.
Sometimes, however, just the ball control thing, sometimes ball control can make things go wrong. So if something goes wrong and you're in ball control, there are times where you're going to have to tough it out and play it like a real player to make sure that you didn't create ball control. There's probably, during a day, there's probably two or three times if somebody's using ball control that they're going to have to go, okay, I got to spend the next hour and a half playing this like a real player to make sure that there's nothing here.
Windows phones, are you guys thinking about doing on that platform?
We have. We actually have that almost done. It's just been prioritized a little lower than some of the other platforms. When, the PS4, we're a relatively small company. We only have so many programmers building new engines for different platforms. And we just prioritized getting the Steam version out, hopefully here in the next couple of weeks, and getting the PS4 version as close to launch as possible. And that's the middle of next month. But we have plans to support it. We've been working with Microsoft specifically on UI ideas and stuff to get it to integrate with their platform.
What about the tables that have credit die?
The credit die.
No, I don't. So Norm can explain.
Okay. Some platforms don't have that. Mostly the reason is that the game doesn't know what time it is or what the date is. And that throws the credit die. And I kind of like it. It makes it so that if you don't know pinball, you don't even notice it's there. If you do, you go, why is there a credit dot? I kind of like that. I think the 360, is that? I don't remember which, but I think the 360 didn't have that. But all of the rest of them do.
Any more?